The issue of the AIF report that we will have to deal with today, as it is the deadline tomorrow for the consolidation of this report into one parliamentary report. So just before I hope that we will be able to deal with the issue of this report and dispose of it quickly before we start with our official workshop program. If you don't mind, I want to move over so that I can see the recording. Otherwise, it's sitting on my desk. Doesn't cut it for me. Yeah. I'm okay. I sincerely hope, honorable members, you can dispose of this matter quickly. I believe you have received the draft. Now, just perhaps briefly, we will know that there is the review of the state-owned enterprises that's currently taking place. Audible?
Yes. Yeah.
All right. So that review requires that Parliament makes its own input in terms of the entities that are under the purview of the various committees of Parliament. In our case, we do not have an entity per se. What we have is the African Renaissance Fund, which in terms of the schedules of the PFMA is regarded as an entity. It doesn't function as a state-owned enterprise per se, but it functions as a fund set up for a specific purpose in terms of the Act. And as such, it is also then part of this review. So there is a draft. There is a draft that has been circulated amongst members. In terms of the draft, basically deals with the areas that have been or where the committee has conducted its oversight since the inception of the fourth parliament. There has been a lot of work done in this regard. Some of the honourable members will recall we've dealt with the AIF since 2009. So these are the various areas under the AIF in the report that have been dealt with. You will note, honourable members, that at the end of the report, there's a couple of recommendations, four recommendations, with regard to the ARF. Perhaps I should draw your attention especially to the last one, which speaks to the dissolution eventually of the ARF and the establishment of the South African Partnership Development Agency. So these recommendations have been made with due regard to that impending reality. Honourable members, let me open the floor to you let's engage on the draft in front of us. Can you pass the mic? No.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I do have a problem with the resolution, but let me tell you what my problem is. And that is this. First of all, it doesn't answer the question that I put to, I think it was the Director General last time round, in the first instance, when I indicated that the ARS was a product of a statute of Parliament. It was an act. That was an act that created. Now, what we're going to do is replace that with just an agreement, and I'm not quite sure how that would work in practice. But more importantly, there's a standard problem. I think when we looked at the document, two fundamental problems emerge out of that document which we don't really address in the resolution. And one is this, that the capacity to actually monitor, and that you will see a 4.7, the accountability mechanism, and that seems to be the weakest link, as they've indicated, identified by the committee, is the lack of proper monitoring and evaluation mechanism. And second of all, and linked to that, is 4.3, the strategic plan, where they said by its very nature there are no set outputs against which the committee can measure the work of the fund. So there are no outputs, and therefore you can't measure and monitor exactly what the monies are going to be used for and what the output is. So we adopt a set of resolutions which quite frankly don't address those two fundamental problems which are identified in the core of the document. So in a sense, it's a kind of useless set of resolutions. All it does say is that the ARS should assume, I mean the ADBA, should assume the responsibility for South Africa's outgoing debt and assistance, the established cohort of format to be external. You see, there's nothing in the actual recommendations except the second point, sorry, that's the point that I actually meant. The project management monitoring and evaluation capacities should be enhanced. Well, now how are they going to be enhanced? Because you talk about the Department of International Relations having that type of capacity, that the Department of International Relations cannot and will not have that type of capacity, because those are nine functions to monitor the output. So I think the resolution is kind of meaningless. Because the answer set of outputs set out in strategic terms, we don't have the mechanisms. We say we're going to gear up the department to monitor, and the department, by its very nature, will not have the capacity to monitor because they don't have the skills. The department's skills are in a totally different area, that's international relations, not monitoring how much, how good, for instance, or how well spent the rand given to Zimbabwe are spent in farming projects.
Okay. Now, thank you, Honorable Davidson. Honorable Dilo.
Sorry, what I wanted to say is about, it's on the same line. For instance, if I take Zimbabwe, are the Zimbabwe qualified to give that money? Was there a survey done to see that they really need it? For as far as I know, their growth rate on agriculture is much higher than ours at the moment. And is there any monitoring of the money? Who does the money go to? Because we know that there was, especially on the farming, it was a productive farming area, and we don't know who's the money going to. Is it going to politicians? Is it going direct to the farmer? And how are they utilizing the money? So that is very important. Before we put any money anywhere, we must know exactly where that money is coming from, and there must be some. There must be monitoring. And if, as my colleague said, monitoring is so important. Otherwise, it's no use. We're sitting with money and dishing out money, and we don't know if there's more needs somewhere else in the world.
Okay, thank you, Honorable
Thank you, Honorable Chair. My only sort of last recommendation, the last page.
It's not clear to me what to be recommended, actually.
If you read that paragraph, you will see that it's one of the conceptual products of evidence, which is the basis of a new agency, the self-path. Now, the champions of African development policy of the gender of Africa and other countries. Cabinet approves the framework in December 2009. But what do we recommend? Is it clear to me? Do we recommend it should be implemented for what? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I concur with what the member said, that the last one doesn't fit nicely into the Chair, I think what we should not lose track of is those departments that in our country that deals with finances on its own, even in relation to you know, creation of any funds, and I think the concerns that the members raised, those things, the majority of them are captured in the duties of the finance department of South Africa, and in most instances is in cooperation with departments. And if we go back to that, we will then see what the prescript in South Africa is if there are any, let's say, transactions. What are they being guided by? So it is either we are unhappy with the current prescripts that we have, because short of that, you then either put into this report all of that and say to all of us that we must be mindful of whatever the PFMA or whatever it says when we do all of these things. Because I don't think it is right to say that there is no capacity. By its very nature, this department deals with how very many, you know, offices around the country. And I think we've had the CFO here many times speaking to us on the difficulties that they have to deal with, and how it has been possible to do certain things. So I think what we maybe should do with this report, Chair, is maybe beef up the recommendations so that the recommendations reflect some of the concerns. Because if you look in the report, in the earlier pages of the report, I thought that some of those issues would have been quite helpful in bringing them to the back page of the report. So I'm not sure, Chair, if we have to spend some 5 minutes to do summary working or any other suggestions.
Oh. Okay, thank you. Honorable members, I've heard what you said. But remember, we are not developing, this is not a completely new report. This is basically a summary of what we have been doing, because the question in terms of the SOA review is what an outline of the purview of the committee in terms of the entity, this case the fund, and what the committee has been, what has been reported to the committee, of course of significance, over the period, and what the recommendations of the committee were. Now, if you want to add new recommendations, that's fine. But what you see at the end as the recommendations are in fact extracts from minutes of the committee and the PRRR. So these are not new recommendations, you know, for purposes of a report in terms of SOE review. These are extracts from previous minutes of the committee and the PRRR report. So these recommendations are there. They are not new. They are there. They are in records of the committee. So this merely then, therefore, is a report of what the work that the committee has done and the information received by the committee in terms of what the department has been doing. So yes, if there are problems in terms of the issues of capacity, you know, in terms of monitoring, then perhaps we must have a broader discussion around that capacity. What capacity do we need? In fact, what capacity does the department need to monitor which aspect of the fund? So I'm saying we then need a broader discussion around the issue of the ARF. But this really is a synopsis of previous reports in terms of the ARF. It's not a completely new, And some of the honorable members here will recall we've had these discussions previously, and some of these issues have been noted. Honorable Hillock, we raised the very same issues, in fact, with regard to Zimbabwe, because our concern at the time in the committee was how do we know this does not, why it may not be recorded here in terms of, which NGOs, but members of the committee will recall, we were given a list, Honorable Dudley, a complete list of the, because there was trilateral cooperation between the department and, civil society organizations in Zimbabwe. The understanding, if I recall correctly, the understanding we had at the time is there was no money transferred to the Zimbabwean government. It was used, through other agencies and so on that were on the ground doing the work. But again, the point in this report really is to say we have received a report from the department on this particular issue. And these are the amounts that were spent there and so on. Really not to delve into, the nuts and bolts of who was given how many for what purposes, but that the department has reported on this and this is how the money was spent. So I just hopefully we at least on the same page on that, but noted on the same. Who else wants to take it? Okay, can I
make a
couple
of First of all, I'm happy to go along with the report as a whole, but I just think that some of the recommendations must be changed, and I think we have to beef up the second bullet point, which talks about the monitoring. And I think we've got to include in there the necessity to establish a set of objectives and outputs in that context against which any monitoring should take place. And of course I go along with the fact that we've got to beef up the capacity to monitor. And incidentally, that capacity can be in conjunction with other departments of government. It doesn't necessarily have to be DIRCO itself. It can be other departments of government. But I think what is critical also in this report is this, that there's no nexus between your discussion on the ARF and then suddenly SAPA. Now, at the last meeting, we were given a briefing as to the necessity to change from ARF to SAPA. That's not in the report. And so the last bullet point doesn't make any sense because there's no motivation in the report for the recommendation. So what we need to do is we need to include a paragraph in the report which indicates why the ARF as presently constituted is no longer suitable, no longer viable functionary body to be able to implement the aims and objectives that have been set out, and then you can come with the recommendation that the ARF is superseded by SAPA. Then it kind of makes sense. Does that help?
Yeah. No, thank you. I think that assists us greatly, Honourable September.
On the second bullet, I'm not sure, Honorable Davidson, doesn't it help the last, it says here compliance with the relevant legislation should be met. Does that sentence need to be elaborated in the concern that you have, or doesn't that cover? So instead of listing, the long list of laws that you need to have that covers your concern. I mean, that's my point again. I thought that this covered with, with that that sentence, unless we want to make it a bulkier sentence that gives a finer detail of what you said. But I thought that was okay. But for the rest, I think we can go along with that.
Okay. All right. Okay. I think what should be the Honorable Davidson has also pointed out the issue of establishment of, or at least setting out clear, you know, objectives and outputs in terms of that. That's what should be added as well with regards to that. As regards the monitoring and evaluation capacities and so on accountability, I think that is fine. That the other objectives of all should be reworked into that paragraph. I think that's how I understood you. Thanks, Honorable Dudley.
Thank you. Yes, I agree that we need to be more specific about how we're going to be able to measure things for the monitoring, because that last sentence in bullet 2 actually should go without saying. Of course the project should be in accordance with the proposal, so it's kind of odd. But my confusion was a little bit with the first bullet. The ARS should assume the responsibility, so were we given the mandate to decide whether they should or whether they shouldn't, or was there some kind of research done or somebody who looked into it or something we're referring to in terms of agreeing that they should pick that up? Because I'm just sort of thinking it's just like we arbitrarily deciding that they should pick it up, and I'm not sure what's gone into that decision that we've made then. The established coordinating mechanism for all matters related to external funding should be put into practice. Was that not in practice beforehand? It just sort of seems odd that it should suddenly be in practice if it wasn't in practice, or was it and we haven't been doing it, or whatever. So I'm just thinking that bullet opens up to a whole lot of questions.
Oh, okay. No, I think it's okay. No. I understand exactly where you come from, Honorable Member. Perhaps it should be more specific, because you will recall that in our discussion, part of the problem that we identified was that various departments are doing various work in the international field. In fact, you have in Zimbabwe, for instance, you have the Department of Public Service and Administration, you have the Department of Environmental, you have Agriculture, you have all these various government departments, each doing work on its own. So you will recall that the idea was to say that this development assistance should be coordinated through one, you know, single structure such as the ARM. That's actually what it's supposed to mean, but it should just be tightened up to say that. Right. It should just be, I agree with you, it should just be tightened up. Honorable Suleiman.
Thank you, Chair. Thinking about time constraints, this report that we adopted today, not the in tomorrow, the possibility of doing it can change, it seems to be more semantics actually. Can we do it? Can the Commission do it? And then we agree to that.
Yeah, okay. Honorable, no, I mean, well, to me it goes without saying, it will probably be adopted if the committee agrees with the changes as proposed. Okay. Did you want to say?
I so moved that we do adopt the change the report.
What with the changes? Okay, that's the proposal with the changes. Seconded? Okay, thanks. Seconded by Honorable Dudley. All right. No objection. Agreed to. No, thank you, Honorable Members. That then concludes the report with the necessary changes that we're now. Let me, at this point, clear the meeting closed and head over to His Honorable September to do the welcome here of the workshop. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also say good morning to everyone. Priya Mora, assalamu alaikum to everyone. In welcoming you here this morning,
Let me first of all extend a heartfelt welcome to the following people that we have here in attendance. We have amongst us Dr. Sipamandla Zonde. If he could just indicate where he is. He is from the Institute for Global Dialogue in Pretoria. We have Dr. Petrus de Kock from the South African Institute of International Relations. We have Ms. Catherine Grant, also from the South African International Institute for International Affairs. We have Mr. Clive Tusker from Standard Bank Johannesburg, the Africa Division. A warm welcome to all of you here today. We have asked you to join us here today in what we regard as a very important workshop for this committee, a workshop that we coined the involvement of South Africa's companies and personnel in security-related activities and business abroad, the impact on the conduct of foreign policy abroad. We have asked you to come and deliberate here with us today so that we could have, from outside of Parliament, a bird's-eye view of how you see the issue that we have raised here. We hope that your participation here today will enrich the committee's deliberations on this matter and start to put to rest some of the concerns and sometimes assumptions that are out there on this matter. In many instances, South Africa are quite well known for its participation in very many fora around the world, indeed on the continent, and in many instances, South Africa's engagement are being seen in a very, very positive light wherever we go. As soon as we leave the shores of our beautiful country and we say that we come from South Africa, people are very excited to meet a South African. And we are hopeful that, you know, that continue. Now, sometimes there are difficulties where a South African name would always pop up somewhere in Libya, having done whatever else. That is then perceived as the South African government has taken a decision to send some renegade out there to do something that our constitution and our laws do not prescribe with. And so we think these are the difficulties that we would want to deal with today. I have a little story when I was on a flight from Johannesburg to Cape Town one day, and there was a lady sitting next to me from Kenya, and when I told her who I am and so on, she just got very angry immediately. I couldn't understand why she was so angry. So I probed a little bit, and she said her anger is towards the fact that many South African businesses come into Kenya and they do the most atrocious thing. And in her view, she was just angry with the rest of South Africa because of that. That's what we would want to talk about also here when we talk about businesses abroad. We can't say that in South Africa we must subscribe to certain things, and when we leave the shores of South Africa, we think that we can do opposite stuff. We support humanity, and we support the fact that everyone is to be treated in a particular way, and therefore we hope this discussion can add to all of that here today. So I want to welcome all of you, and indeed welcome the members for attending also here. And Chairperson, I'm giving back to you again to continue with the seminar. Thank you. Two things that I need to say. We are going to have a moderator here. A moderator for the first part is because of two very good Dr. Zondi. And Dr. Zondi, we will bring you.
Thank you very much, and good morning. Good morning, colleague. Thank you very much. If you don't mind, I'll call you colleague, because if I use the proper titles, I might miss somebody. Maybe say honorable and colleague. And the colleagues from civil society would understand. We'll fight our battles later on. So I've been asked to just moderate the first session, which will be, which will constitute two presentations actually from my colleagues, Petrus and Catherine. What I'm going to ask them to do, because I can see we've run behind time a little bit, I'm going to request that they restrict their presentations to no more than 20 minutes. Would that be okay, colleagues? Yeah. We restrict the presentation to about 20 minutes so that we can have a fruitful discussion thereafter. Much appreciated. Thank you very much. Without much further ado, I'm going to invite the chairperson of the portfolio committee, Honorable Makama, to give us a bit of background and overview on this meeting so that we know what we're talking about.
Thank you, colleague. Morning once again, honorable members and colleagues, presenters. Perhaps just as a brief background, in 2010, the committee met and one of the issues brought under its attention was the conduct of South African business abroad, in Africa and abroad. Correctly, as Honorable September said, there were a number of issues raised in connection to the conduct of South African business. May I add that in addition to the best things that were said, I think generally the feedback was a good one in terms of, you know, how South African business conducted itself. At the time, there was talk of a code of conduct for South African business. Now, the committee at the time resolved to look into the matter and apply its mind, you know, in terms of investigating the factors that led to the need for some to propose that such a code of conduct should be called in place. Now, in 2010, the presidency announced the deliberate policy of economic diplomacy. You will recall that the presidency, you know, or the president in his visits started taking huge delegations of South African business wherever he went to. In an attempt to cement and expand South African business or trade with other countries around the globe. Now, this, honorable members, was of course aimed at deepening economic relations and ensuring growth and building partnerships across the globe. Now, South Africa's many businesses are indeed operating in Africa and beyond. The country's footprint is evident in the global markets, in goods and services, culminating in South Africa competing with the best in the world. However, reports about South African business, as we know, have not always been good and positive. South Africans have, amongst others, especially on the African continent, have been implicated in some instances in paramilitarism, in participating in conflicts on the African continent, in being part of people who planned or were orchestrating a plan to overthrow one or the other government of the African continent. But South African companies were also accused of unfair labor practices. You know, outside of the
outside of the Republic. Of course, the expectation was that South African companies doing business beyond the borders of the country will abide or will apply the very same labor laws applicable to them in our country, at least the minimum standards applicable here in the conduct of their businesses elsewhere. So in this context, it became critical for the committee to engage in the debate and on the concept of a code of conduct. However, as I said, the committee resolved to look into the factors that led to this idea by engaging with your both selves and hopefully other stakeholders going forward. The committee also resolved at the time to deal with perceptions also of the role of South African businesses on the African continent, ranging from being seen on the one hand as partners and reliable partners at that in terms of growth, to being viewed as on the other extreme as the new age colonizers, and you throw into the pot what some call Dr. Zondi continental jealousy. These of course also play a part in terms of the perceptions that that are coming up. Now, it is our expectation, and it should be, that South African businesses conduct abroad should be complementary, not contrary, to the aspiration of South Africa's foreign policy. Now, it will be useful for us to debate this issue, honourable members, and learn more on the successes accrued and the inherent challenges that are facing South African companies as South Africa continues to expand beyond its own borders. It will also, of course, benefit the company to know if there could be other approaches to this issue, not just necessarily confine our thinking to a code of conduct per se. The committee initially supported the idea of a code, but a code that was meant to facilitate and not impede business operations. Of course, taking into account the fact that there is what some call a new scramble for African markets, and especially Africa's natural resources. Now, through the activities of the ARF and other interventions, conflict situations on the continent are indeed lessening, there is a growing environment for sustainable economic activity on the African continent. It could therefore only be fair that South African companies, like any other company from any part of the globe, also benefit from these developing environments and by engaging in business activity. However, it is in our interest that we see these businesses conducting themselves in a way that will protect and enhance the image of the country through, amongst others, practicing fair labor practices, being opposed to corruption and ill discipline, and of course also operating within the laws of their host countries, and of upholding our values of Ubuntu in keeping with international standards. Now, it will also benefit us, honourable members, as to know if such a code of conduct comes into existence, who will be in charge of such a code of conduct to ensure that it achieves what it set out to achieve. Really, the question is, should such a code of conduct be within government? Should it be within business itself? Some self-regulation. Perhaps they have. No, chief. Thank you. Yeah, as I said, it will be important for us to understand exactly who will be responsible for this code of conduct to ensure its desired effectiveness. Should it be within government? Should it be within business? Some sort of a self-regulating mechanism, the buzzword of these days. You know, should it perhaps be, should there be perhaps a regional protocol of some sort? Should it reside within the African Union? You know, who in the final analysis, you know, should be responsible for the for holding South African business accountable to such a code? So these are some of the issues that we need to apply our minds to, you know, when we get these briefings and engage going forward. Now, perhaps let me just elucidate a couple of the challenges. There's the issue of image that I've raised earlier. There's the issue of the involvement in this paramilitary activities. These are serious issues, especially on a continent where the drive really is to eradicate the conflict. You know, it's common cause that South Africa, I mean, Africa's curse, perhaps, has been said by many to be its natural endowment, that which really makes Africa, that which should contribute to its development, actually is what's the cause to its demise, and which is its natural resources. Let me reiterate, we are well aware, and we should always be cognizant of the fact that most companies, South African companies, are good companies, and they do good in the countries where they operate. We can quote a lot who are even involved in social upliftment, social development programs everywhere on the African continent. They are involved in infrastructure development, in investment, in human resource development, and so on. So there's a lot of good work that is happening as well. I think it's the proverbial a few apples in the bunch that are really drawing the, you know, the attention to this issue. However, honourable members, this also points to a need for a stronger emphasis on public diplomacy. This we have highlighted on several occasions. On the one hand, of course, to end the scourge of this smear campaign against, you know, our country in general, but also against South African business. And also to sensitize, on the other hand, business about the possible strains that emanate from when their conduct is not so good. Now, let me finally say, honourable members, that it is in the final analysis in the interest of our country and its people that we continue to expand, but we do so in a way that will enhance the relationship between South African business and the governments and people of the host countries. This is absolutely crucial to the ever expanding business and trade interests of South African business, but especially because economic diplomacy is the one tool that should assist us to deal with our own domestic priorities. And so it is in our interest as a country that the conduct of our business is exemplary. It conforms to our own law. It conforms to the laws of the host countries. But at the end of it all, it conforms to international best practice. We accordingly seek your input as to what needs to be done to address these threats to South Africa's foreign policy, to the South African foreign policy objectives, and indeed how the committee can contribute to the future guide on business engagements in the globe, but in particular on the African continent. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable. Given us quite a good guide to talk through, given us quite a lot of food for thought as we listen to the presentations from my two colleagues. I'm going to ask them to come in the order that is in the program. I'm going to ask Petros to come first. Petros is with the Governance of Natural Resources Program at the South African Institute of International Affairs. I think it's the oldest think tank in international affairs in the country, and he is the youngest member of it. So thank you very much. Petros.
Thank you, Dr. Zondi. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, good morning. Thank you for the invitation to share some thoughts with you on this. Can we try to position the mic on this? Let's see if that works. Can you hear me? I believe all of you got a copy of my presentation. I didn't write it into a narrative text. I think it was in the spirit of just sharing some thoughts and kind of initiating a discussion. I just thought I will identify some key issues and I will talk my way through the document, and we'll be open for questions and discussions afterwards. As you can see in the first instance, the issue that I'm talking to is the very problematical question of South African, let's call them, the fancy word used is private security companies or private military companies, and in the old terminology we would talk about mercenaries or hired guns. But I think the term mercenary and the imagery in our minds associated with it, the reality has moved on quite dramatically. Since the end of the Cold War, and this is a comment I make on the second page, since the end of the Cold War in particular, there's been a huge increase globally in the amount of those type of companies, the type of services that they render, and also the type of clientele that call on those kind of services. So I want to create just that international context, and then I'll get into some specific questions around South Africa. Just in terms of background, there are two international conventions that I'm sure you're aware of. There's the 1977 Organization of African Unity Convention on Mercenaries, and there is the UN Convention of 1989 also dealing with the question of mercenaries and mercenarism, as it is called. And then in our context, in the South African legislative framework, we have got the Regulation of Foreign Ministry Assistance Act of 1998, and then the second one, the Prohibition of Mercenary Activities and Regulation of Certain Activities in Areas of Armed Conflict. And just a comment on that, if you read the writings or research on attempts by states to curtail or to control the activities of your private security firms, South Africa is probably the most advanced in the world in terms of not only legislation, but also in grappling with that issue. But if you look on page 2 in the section on the context, I'm just going to talk to some of the issues there. As I noted, since the end of the Cold War, there's been quite a significant increase in the amount of these type of companies, and the use of the private military contractors in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. I think in the last decade, those cases really brought international attention to the impact of contracting private military service providers into active conflict. If you look at the case of Blackwater, it's an American company, a huge company. They draw on U.S. Marines and U.S. Special Forces. It's a billion-dollar industry in itself, that one company. If you look at some of the cases in the Iraq war, for example, where there were some very controversial incidences where civilians were killed in some incidences where they were protecting U.S. personnel or U.S. armed personnel, and that drew a lot of criticism to not only the United States government, but also to the principle or the practice of private military contractors. And the one key problem with it is that they do not fall in your regular military chain of command. So they cannot be held accountable as a soldier or as a unit that's deployed in your official structure. So they kind of operate in a bit of a legal, one would say, grey area, you know, where accountability is a huge problem. And secondly also, if we look at the conduct of the Iraq war, at the height of the US deployment, I think the Americans had about 150,000 to about 160,000 troops in the field. I don't have accurate numbers, but some estimates that I've seen would say that the Americans contracted an equal amount of private military contractors, you know, either 100,000 or more private military contractors. So that nearly doubled the force that they had on the ground. So anyway, what I'm trying to say with this is, in the international context, there's been a huge development in terms of how these companies work, where they go, and what they do. But also an important thing is that your excess or your retired military personnel from countries like the United Kingdom, for example, a pattern that's been emerging in the United Kingdom in the last few years is you have the SAS, the Special Air Service, which is basically their special service or the special ops kind of unit, and often guys would retire from that service and immediately would be hired into some of these private security firms to conduct all kinds of interesting types of operations. But in that same section on the context, I say that cases where private security companies and mercenary activities can compromise, undermine, and negatively impact, now we're talking about South Africa or South Africa's foreign policy, would be cases where such organizations or agents of those organizations are involved in coups. There's that classic case of the Simon Mann and Nick de Toey, they call it the Wonga coup of a few years ago, or the coup attempt, rather. Then there's the activities of the very well-known, notorious one, Executive Outcomes, of a few years ago that's been disbanded in the meanwhile. But I'll talk about that a bit more later on. And another way that these kind of activities could undermine South Africa's foreign policy is when it undermines our human rights stance. So let's say, for argument's sake, you have a case where there's a private security company that's registered in South Africa and they get involved in activities that does not respect either international human rights law in terms of the conduct of war, or they get involved in cases where there's human rights abuses that take place. Even though the South African government may not endorse those activities, it reflects really negatively on the country. So I think that is something, given South Africa's position on the continent and also our international standing, I think it's a very good thing for the South African government to be highly sensitive to that type of activity, and especially the impact it may have on the image of South Africa. And not even then to speak about concrete, practical foreign policy and trying to achieve certain objectives in international space. And I'll talk more about the Libya case. I think in the Libya case, and I'm not going to talk about whether there's any proof or not to the example that came through Libya, but the one thing that happened in the Libya case is last year when we had reports coming through either saying that South African mercenaries have been contracted to train and support some of the rebels, and then the case came through of Saif al-Islam, Muammar Gaddafi's son, as well as Muammar Gaddafi himself being protected by South African private security firms. Now, as I said, I'm not going to get into whether there's any truth to this or not. Let's use those as two scenarios, in a way, two scenario cases where you have South African companies involved on two sides of a very controversial conflict. The question is, can you stop that as a business activity? I think that's a big legal debate that I saw a very interesting report on recently that deals with this question. The other side of this question is, if such things happen, I think the question would then be, how will the South African government regulate, approve, and track those type of activities? And I'll get to that a bit more in a moment in one of the other sections. But I think before we dig maybe deeper into the South African government's approach to this problem, or this issue rather, I think there are some operational issues we have to keep in mind. You know, just to kind of keep in our minds, what do these companies do, why do they do it, and so forth. So I think if you look at the third section, operational issues on page 2, I say that as a result of the range of clients that call on private security company services, and I should just mention there, the clients of these companies are shockingly vast. States, rebel movements, oil exploration companies, you name it. You know, there's a tremendous range of clients to the services of these type of companies. But As a result of the range of clients and the changing nature of warfare in the 21st century, and I make a note there, you know, we have a very distinct shift in the late 20th to into the 21st century into what we can more call fourth generation network-centric war, insurgency, terrorist network activity, you know, where you cannot have a conventional military response. And where guys in the private security industry are very well positioned to provide low-key, often contracted services to a state entity or a non-governmental entity. Now, an example of this is, you remember earlier I spoke about executive outcomes. Now, what's been happening in the last while is there's another company with the name Saracen International. It's registered in South Africa, and it's active in two places. I encountered Saracen in Uganda on Lake Albert on the oil developments that's happening in Uganda, so they provide protection for the oil operations on Lake Albert. And another place where Saracen has appeared is actually in Somalia, where there's a very interesting case where this Saracen company has been involved in training militia in Somalia. But coincidentally, in the same area where the training is taking place, there's a Canadian company, I think it's called Frontier Resources. They're exploring for oil. And it's happening in the kind of zone between Somaliland and Puntland. And the story of oil in Somalia is quite big, by the way, but that's not on our list of issues today. So the two types of services that these companies provide would be either lethal. Lethal services would be things like operational deployments, where they provide command support structures in the field. They provide defensive or offensive services to the client. But then your more non-lethal services would be like training, advisory services, intelligence gathering, counterinsurgency advisory, those type of activities. Now, something else that's interesting, and I think that's important, maybe also from a South African legal perspective to look at it, is that in international humanitarian law, no provision is made for a special category for private military contractors in conflict. In international humanitarian law, you basically have the division between you have your combatants and your civilians. Now, what happens now is because the contractors do not fall under an official military command structure, they are kind of classified as civilians, but they clearly are not, because these are guys deployed often in the field to provide certain lethal services. So what this means, what I said earlier, they kind of end up in a bit of an international legal no man's land. And that puts, I think, brings it back, the onus back to the South African government and South African policymakers to decide how will we regulate our domestic industry. So this brings me to my last section, and Dr. Zondi, I hope I'm sticking to time, I'm going as quickly as I can. On page 3, I have a section on South African policy challenges, and I'm going to go through in a bit more detail through this, and I think there maybe we can have the foundation for a bit of a discussion. As I said at the beginning, South Africa is one of the world's most advanced legislative codes aimed at controlling private security company activities. And this is largely a result of our own history, where we have the demobilization of soldiers from the apartheid armed forces, and it's like executive outcomes. They were created from the remnants of the old 3-2 battalion that were very notorious in the era of the Angolan War. And then I get back to the example of the Libya case. In 2011, several rumors and reports surfaced about South African private security companies active on the side of Libyan rebels, and that the group had been contracted to protect Muammar Gaddafi and some of his family members. Now, the latter type of cases can reflect negatively on South African foreign policy, especially if such reports question South African policy. And also, more controversially, whether there was any direct or indirect link between the South African government and the private security company activity in Libya. And let me talk off the page now for a moment. I was called up during last year quite a bit to do commentary and some analysis on the Libyan case. And you know what I found quite disturbing is in monitoring media reports on the Libyan case and the South African response to it, there was as if certain opinions were formed or formulated to actively undermine President Zuma and the South African government's stance on Libya, especially in the early stages of the conflict where President Zuma and other regional presidents were pushing very hard for a mediated attempt at a mediated settlement. And then afterwards you started seeing these reports surfacing of South African mercenaries active either on the side of the rebels or on the side of the Gaddafi government. So then all these questions started coming through. What's the relationship between the ANC and Libya, or between individual members of the government and Libya, and so forth? Now, the reason I thought that as being problematical is that South Africa had a very, in my mind, constructive position within the African Union and how it lobbied for another type of solution that would have prevented this kind of NATO no-fly zoning position. But what happened ultimately is that it started questioning the whole South African foreign policy drive based on these very flimsy, in some cases, allegations. So I think that is where, you know, there's a big issue that one has to dig into in much more detail probably. Now, I would say there's two, in terms of the two types of services that I outlined earlier, you have your kind of lethal services, where you have private security companies that would actually actively participate in armed conflict, defensively, offensively, and so forth. And then you have your softer kind of services. Now, what I'd say there at point three is that the soft private security company services, such as protection, training, military assistance, those are relatively non-controversial. However, the South African government could consider stricter controls over private security companies that provide the following type of services in conflict environments. When private security companies are positioned at military-specific locations to provide either offensive or defensive services in theater where you have a conflict. When private security companies are contracted to provide specific targeted killing services, and those would kind of blend with your realm of covert operations. And make no mistake that these private security companies are hired in the international space for very specific and sometimes very questionable activities like that. In Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, you see, one sees those kind of things happening. When private security companies utilize and are contracted to provide high-tech and unmanned weapon systems services, and I'm going to digress in a moment on that topic, or when they have to provide things like electronic surveillance and information operation activities. Why do I mention this thing about unmanned weapon systems? I'm just going to give you one brief example. 2001, when 9/11 happened, the American military had about 700 unmanned aerial vehicles in their whole system. By last year, by 2011, it was more than 7,000, probably even more. So in one decade, there's been a tremendous revolution in the development, deployment, and active use of unmanned weapon systems. Your drones, they would refer to, would be referred to. I think the cases that are most prominent would be Pakistan, where there's constant attacks by the CIA on Al-Qaeda targets, and that has led to a lot of tension also between the Pakistani government and the US government. The reason I flag this is that this thing is creeping deeper into the African space as well. The United States opened a drone base in Ethiopia just last year. There's a drone base that's operated from the Seychelles. The French, I think, also have a drone base, an unmanned weapons, unmanned aerial service running also from one of the islands here off the east coast of Africa. So why I mention that is that in terms of our understanding of the future of conflict, I think that's a very important issue. And we have to monitor what private military providers are active in that space. Anyway, that's something for another day as well. I just thought I should highlight that a bit. Now, in point number four, I say the Foreign Military Assistance Act of 1998 prevents any foreign military assistance without prior authorization from the National Conventional Arms Control Committee. It may be necessary, after looking at the Libya case especially, I think it may be necessary to audit, review, and interrogate the current regime to determine its effectiveness and whether there is a need for further change to prevent cases where the South African government may be either embarrassed or where its foreign policy objectives are directly undermined by private security company activities. I think those would be the two biggest challenges to confront in this case. In the case of point number four, it may also be necessary to interrogate the extent to which the National Conventional Arms Control Committee decisions on foreign military assistance is informed by, and I think the four key entities here, I'm not in that realm, so I don't know the exact chain through which those approval systems work, but I think it's very important, looking back at Libya, that DECA, the Department of International Relations, our diplomatic activities, the South African Secret Service, and definitely the domestic intelligence, and probably even military intelligence, should be your first line to inform the government on what is South Africa doing in a specific country. Let's take Libya for example. What is the South African government trying to achieve? And with that as a background, based on that, then you make a decision whether you allow a private security company to go and work in that space. I think that's the priority in terms of making the decision. And I think there it's very important to draw on those assets of the South African state to inform, I think, I would say, a more holistic type of decision. So decisions whether to allow private security companies to act in this in specific theatres have to be assessed against the backdrop of ongoing South African diplomatic, economic and other engagements in countries where these private companies apply to render their services. And this may help to prevent the unnecessary embarrassment or negative impacts on South African foreign policy. And maybe just to wrap up, I think to reiterate something that I said earlier, I think this issue is very important, I think, from my perspective, to engage with from a South African perspective, given our role on the continent, and given the unintended consequences. You know, today you may make a decision to allow a certain private security company to act in a certain country, but it's very unpredictable what those guys may actually, in the operational realm, go and do. So one must be very careful in allowing such activities, especially when it can hit back at the government, even though the government isn't sponsoring or isn't the client, you know, of these companies and their activities. And maybe just one thing I should say, in my preparations for this, I came across a very handy report. I referred to it there, the references. The second one, by Bosch and Maritz, South African Private Security Contractors Active in Armed Conflict, Citizenship Prosecution and the Right to Work. I think that's a worthwhile read, you know, also from a legal perspective. I think they engage much more in depth with some of the legal issues and in the South African context. So, Honourable Chair, that's my submission. I hope at least I covered some of the ground, and I'm open for some questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, I take guess this one I conduct. Thank you very much, Patrice, for a quick roundup of a very complex subject and for doing it in a manner that made it sound a lot easier than I thought it was. So we have a round of questions and comments, and we'll see how many rounds we would have. So basically, it's an interactive session where we ask questions or comment on what Petrus has said or contribute or disagree with him. Because he's an academic, we can tear him apart. It's part of our practice. There are no cordial rules in academic course. Thank you very much. I recognize one hand. Is there another hand? I see two hands. Let's start with you. Please introduce yourself and keep it brief. Thank you very much. There's a hand at the back. This one is also on. Feedback from another one. The general sound is poor.
Thanks, Chief. Thank you. Interesting presentation. You went quite fast for the sign language interpreter here, but I hope she covered everything that you said. The one question that I do have, and I'm wondering if you can give me clarity. So whatever is happening, whether it's for or against South Africa, I just want to know the role of our embassies in those various countries, especially those countries of conflict, if there is any of these private companies going into these countries. So what is the role of the embassies in South Africa? And then secondly, when we do read the newspapers, we hear about child soldiers being trained. I'd like to know how South African, these private companies, are they involved in such training? I'd like to know. And then thirdly, it's a concern when one obviously reads in the media, and your presentation is obviously looking at where these private companies are rendering the service to other countries, the outlook internally. All these companies right now, who have noticed and read in the media, those who were killed overseas or are looking for protection here, or our country provides protection for those people here, or they're hiding in South Africa here, when they are found, then they have one protection from our government here. But yet they've done these mercy activities in other countries, so they come back to South Africa and they hide. So let me give you an example. Right now, I think there's a Russian person who is accused of killing a gang leader in his own country. I'm not too sure in what country. And he came and is now looking for protection in South Africa. However, he gets involved in the crime world here, but obviously these are laws protecting from going back to another country. So what is the role in that? What is our role concerning that? And then, I just want to know about bounces. I'm involved in security companies here in South Africa, but those security companies are linked to foreign countries as well. I just want to know. I'm not too sure if you got my question then. So then, also after your presentation, I'm now just thinking to myself, at the waterfront, for example, at the restaurant, the Planet Hollywood, for example, there was a bomb that went off there, or there was a bomb scare. The perception that people got there is that we have a American company in our own country. The people are angry and therefore they act out because of the American countries that are involved in certain countries and that also here in our own country. So we inadvertently allow those businesses, American businesses, to set up here, but our own people are angry towards these companies. So our people are not protected when these things happen. How is that also linked to your topic, and how should you go to learn it?
Thank you very much, honorable member here, on my right.
Thank you. I'm Will Hill from the committee.
Okay.
I would just like to know how many companies, South African companies, and how many people are involved in security all over the world. And I would like to know, I would like to mention, because there's always competition amongst companies, the services rendered, the services they give. So if there isn't some like an international binding legislation or agreement amongst countries. So one country will allow a company to do this, and the other company will allow it to do this. And is there any monitoring that a company can have to apply for a permit to do this kind of work in a specific country, and every time you want to expand your services to another country that you have to apply again? And is there any monitoring from us on this company, and in what way? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do I have another? Oh, yes, the gentleman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the input. What I found useful is the definition of lethal and non-lethal. But I think it's an incomplete definition, and I think there has to be the or more meat has to be put onto the bone as far as that's concerned. Because I gather from what you say that the non-lethal type is more acceptable. But I'm just concerned that there may be a grey area between the lethal and non-lethal, and therefore if one's going to regulate in any way, it can be somewhat difficult. I'd also like greater clarity as to how the legislation that we have, that's the prohibition of mercenary activities, etc., how that may wander into the territory of PSD, does it or does it not? And thirdly, the more fundamental question is, how do you regulate an industry of this nature? I can understand, let me go back one, a company can be registered abroad, but it can have operatives in South Africa, recruited in South Africa. Now, that will happen. How do you regulate that, essentially? And how does that possibly interfere with the concept that it gets regulated? How does it interfere with the concept which you mentioned of Bosch and Brin, and that is the right to work? Now, I'm not familiar with that, so perhaps you could explain very briefly of that right to work and how any such regulation could impinge on that concept.
Thank you very much. The honourable member listening to me. And then honourable Makama.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Brian Tillman, member of this committee. You mentioned here in your report that in South Africa and United America, they have domestic legislation controlled by private security companies. We've heard a lot about activities in foreign countries. Maybe you mentioned more of that. But you never read about what's been done to the return to Africa. Maybe it could be some research and enlightenment. It strikes me that nothing's done to them because we don't read about it. So this, and we do have legislation to take action against this illegal activity of the security world. So we can have much more information about that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Makam.
No, thank you. The three quick ones from me. Do we have an idea of whether the South African state utilizes PSD in its operation? Secondly, do we have an idea as to the extent of our citizens' involvement? We know there was a time where it looked almost fashionable for body bags to be returned to South Africa from, in particular at the time in Iraq. There were cases in Afghanistan. So you had those, of course, some of them fall within the category of what Mr. Davidson said, where they actually work for other companies, for other people, companies registered in other countries. But then there's the issue of the right to work. Is it covered in terms of the current legislation? And then lastly, so do we have really an idea of the extent of South African involvement as with every individual? You will recall there were reports around the many of the former South African Defense Force soldiers, many of whom were stationed at home front, and others demobilized, who for some reason nobody knows where they are. Some of them have been discovered, for instance, in Guinea, and some have been spotted in Iraq and other conflicts in place. And then lastly, the review review and audit, as you said, of the current legislation is one of the important challenges. Do you have an idea what would be the area of that review? What would be the focus area specifically? Because you can review, the effectiveness of your legislation. But you will have to do so from a point of understanding that it's inadequate in certain areas of implementation or enforcement. And as such, if you need a review, will it be, for instance, to deal with issues such as the non-lethal part of the operation? To include that perhaps? How?
how possible is it, you know, to really cover that whole spectrum of issues, you know. So, yeah, that's it.
Thank you very much, and I think to be fair to Petrus, I have given quite a lot to mull over.
Okay, I'll do my best on the question. In terms of the question on the role of the embassies, South African embassies in the conflict areas, I would say one of the main roles often that I see for embassies is monitoring of a country or conditions in, and I think especially in conflict-prone areas. So I would say the role of the embassy is probably not to be like a watchdog to look at what all the South African companies are doing in such a space, but I think it would be important, you know, in cases where there's an awareness maybe, you know, of, especially if problems start appearing, if you have private security companies, maybe then the embassy has a function to alert the government or DERCO or some structure in South Africa to activities that may start showing signs of being problematical. That's only when problems start appearing, you know, so I think I could see that as an operational function of the embassies. In terms of child soldiers, I don't think the private security companies, the issue of child soldiers are usually linked to rebel force activity. It's in cases like the Lord's Resistance Army or some of the rebel outfits in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Often, child soldiers are recruited for all kinds of purposes, as labor, to just do physical work in the rebel camps, to cook food, and then to be trained as a young source of fighters. So I don't think the private security companies are involved in anything of that nature. Now, in terms of the case of mercenaries or people who get into trouble in other parts of the world and coming to South Africa to hide out here, I don't really think it may be directly linked to this case if you have someone who was a mercenary in a place and he flees to South Africa and then he claims protection. But I think then it becomes probably more a home affairs type of issue. You know, will such a person apply for a form of asylum? You know, is there any political grounds on which they would claim that they can't be extradited to another country? So I think then it kind of goes into another realm of legal issues in terms of that person's actual relationship with the South African state and his reasons then for not wanting to be moved anywhere else. The case of, say, the Hollywood, Planet Hollywood bomb here in Cape Town a few years ago, yeah, I think that's basically a kind of perceptual politics issue, you know. If someone perceives the Americans to be a problem and they think you will solve it by bombing a Planet Hollywood store in Cape Town, you know, in my mind it becomes a bit problematical, you know. So that kind of is more, I would say, in the realm of your kind of terrorist activity, you know, and what's the motivation for someone to do something like that, and also not really directly linked to the question of mercenaries and private security company activity. There was a question on how many South African companies and the number of people. I have an interesting list that I got on a site that does quite a bit of deep military research. And there's a list of companies, mercenaries and private military companies, of the 62 big ones in the world, 9 of them are South African companies. So we have a big share, at least in companies that are active in that field. In terms of a headcount of the amount of people, I think my guess would be as good as anybody else's in the room today.
Yes. All those 9 companies, are they
I think there one would probably have to do a very specific kind of analysis of each company, you know. I think there are some of them that would probably straddle both, you know, straddle both those rounds. Yeah, so as I said, you know, in terms of the actual number of people, that's a tough call, you know. That's very difficult to assess. And also by the nature of the business, these companies would be super secretive in most cases about who works for them, where, what do they do, because it's high-level security stuff that they are dealing with. Then the different approaches from this, let me just see, yeah, is there any monitoring of these kind of companies? I think the kind of monitoring that would happen wouldn't happen at any official level, you know. Official level meaning I don't see any United Nations body actively working on that to monitor those kind of companies. I would say, see, you would probably find it more in terms of military and security related research. You know, people that would research those companies would research their activities and try to get a sense of what they do. So I think that's the best place to go and look for good information, you know, on who they are, where they are active. Something that's very interesting that comes through some of the research on in this field is to say that even though we have the UN Convention on Mercenaries, even though we have the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, they've been very active on the front of international humanitarian law and asking questions about the legal status of these companies in conflict. There's an interesting point of view that says that states will sign up, for example, to the UN Mercenary Convention, but then they still carry on using the services of these companies in contravention of the UN Convention. So there's this interesting position that's been coming up that they say that the UN Convention and the international legal foundation of anti-mercenary activity is counter-customary law, you know, because actual practice is totally opposed to what the official legal position would be. So that's an interesting tussle that's happening there. And I think in that space, South Africa is very advanced. We are actually very advanced and very proactive to engage on that front and on that issue. In terms of the definitional issues, I definitely agree there. I don't think I had much, you know, I didn't allow myself much room, you know, to tighten up that definition. But I think in terms of your lethal, non-lethal, definitional kind of issue, I think the important things come in at the level of how do you regulate that, you know. And there, it's, you know, I think any regulatory regime is also open to abuse. You know, so someone can present an activity in a certain way, but meanwhile, you know, actually, you know, on the ground something totally different happens. So I would say the best approach would probably be for, in terms of policy thinking, would be to say, yes, we have to allow room for the right to work. You cannot prohibit people from doing certain kinds of things, but maybe the important thing to do would be is to find a way of being more informed about those kind of activities in sensitive spaces by those companies, and maybe to be more forewarned, basically, you know, about the potential negative consequences of that, you know, because in terms of actually controlling it, I don't know, I honestly don't know how one would go about doing that kind of thing. And I think this links to the other question on how will this South African legislation encroach on these activities, and how do we regulate it? And will this interfere with the right to work? You know, I'm just reading my notes from the question. So I think that would be a case where I mentioned the National Conventional Arms Committee. I think what I meant there in terms of the review, Chair, I think what I meant there is more in terms of the actual decision chain, you know, who's involved in that, who's supposed to do what. So I'm not necessarily thinking of a legislative review. I'm thinking more at a basic chain of command type of issue. Where do people apply? Where does it go to? And who ultimately makes the decision and who provides input on that decision? And that's when I mentioned DIRCO, the intelligence agencies, military intelligence and so forth. I think those would be your key kind of governmental channels that can inform, and DIRCO can inform a government decision about allowing or not allowing a certain activity by a private security company. I have never come across any indication of the South African government using private security companies. I haven't come across anything like that. But as politics goes, one would never know. Anyway, but from my side, I don't have any information on us using things like that. And Chair, in terms of your question, that's your question on whether the South African government utilizes it. Personally, I haven't come across that. What is the extent of the citizens' involvement in this? I think the main indication I have would be this list where we have, out of 62, there are 9 South African companies. which is already quite a strong indication, at least, of companies. I know during the phase of the Iraq and the Afghanistan war, I can also just, you know, from the media reports and people talking, you know, there was a significant amount of South Africans involved. And actually, the interesting thing is the wind down of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, kind of led to a bit of a crisis, I think, in some people's lives, because then they started running out of work. But anyway, and then, and I think I responded to your question on the review and audit of legislation. I don't think it's necessarily about the review and audit of the legislation. It's more about what actual chain, you know, do these things run through, and what sources of information does it draw on to kind of prioritize the South African diplomatic activity or the South African image before, you know, as to prevent any cases where that can negative impact on our image or our activities. So I hope I covered some of the questions. And honourable member, I agree. I think this is an area that can, you know, definitely a lot more work can be done on this, you know, in terms of specifically the South African policy issue. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Petrus. I'm going to release you now, because you can easily comment from the floor later on as the interactive discussion continues. So because of time, we'd like to end this part here, because the two presentations complement each other. Petrus is focusing on security companies, and Catherine is focusing on non-security companies, sort of economic companies. I've heard somebody say so, economic companies. All of it is economic, actually. Yeah, so at this point, I really want to appreciate Petrus. Thank you very much. You did a great job in a very limited time. And at this time, we'll go for tea. Your tea was very generous initially. Can I use my power to ask that we just take 10 minutes to do tea? Is it okay? Thank you very much. So we are back at 10 past 11. Thank you very much. Bye.
The questions you're asking at the beginning, they almost answer the whole question.
Yeah, no, yeah.
The whole stuff is very complex.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It might be more complex than when you take resolution. When you take resolution without making decisions, or when you shout about the writing newspaper about it.
That is actually is the
nature of business is cutthroat competition. And part of it is to stretch the limits of whatever exists. How do you send your boxer into the Western arena and ask them to write by
You're going in with a limp. You're going in with a limp.
I don't want to put my phone.
What's happened to my
phone?
Other guy can put my phone.
Yeah.